Q&A on all topics for long-term care facilities, a conversation with the healthcare experts at Quality Insights.
Good afternoon and welcome to our series of webinars focused on bringing you information about COVID-19 related topics. The information in these weekly webinars is geared toward long-term care and skilled nursing facilities, but we encourage everyone who's interested to attend. My name is Kathy Caudill. I'm a communication specialist with Quality Insights. Today, we'll be having a Q&A on recent updates and other topics related to long-term care. And now I'd like to briefly introduce today's panelists. We have several of our quality improvement specialists here today, Deborah Wright, Penny Imes, Patty Austin, and Shirley Sullivan. And we are also joined by Quality Insights Medical Director, Dr. Jean Storm. So we'll start with some immunization questions. First question says, what are you hearing about inaccuracies with the new up-to-date definition and facility reporting errors?
Thanks, Kathy. I'm going to address this question that we received, and I'm glad we did, because I wanted to give everybody a reminder with your NHSN reporting that beginning with NHSN week that started 9/25. So after week ending 9/24/2023, the up-to-date definition did change to where residents were no longer considered up-to-date unless they were receiving the 2023-2024 updated COVID-19 vaccine, or they had the bivalent vaccine administered within the previous 2 months. So as of your NHSN reporting that started with week 9/25/23, you should have been reporting the majority of your residents and staff has dropping back to 0%. And actually, unless they, as I said, if they have received the 2023-2024 updated COVID vaccine, they are up to date. If they had one of the bivalent vaccines administered in the previous 2 months, they're considered up to date. But we do know that NHSN and DOH really expected to see a lot of facilities drop back to zero, because we know a lot of you did not have the new vaccine at that time. And we're hearing that some facilities that didn't have that significant drop are starting to receive letters inquiring if their NHSN reporting is accurate. And then if not, to go back into NHSN and update the previously reported weeks. So we're really wanted to take this opportunity to remind everybody that you need to go back in and make sure that your NHSN reporting for the weeks starting 9/25/23 are updated. And if your residents, you don't have that new vaccine, you really should be showing up as zero up-to-date vaccines. Thank you.
Thank you, Penny. Our next question asks, can you give the COVID, flu, and RSV vaccine at the same time?
Hi, Kathy. I'll take this one. The CDC does say that the COVID, flu, and RSV vaccines can be given at the same time, that it does not affect the immune response for each of the vaccines that they are given. But it is recommended that you give them at different sites. Now, with that said, if a resident is someone who in the past has experienced side effects or reactions such as fever, headaches, or pain or swelling at the injection site, getting all three of the vaccines at the same time can increase this reaction. So you wouldn't want to spread them out for someone who does experience these side effects. And then also, if a resident is immunocompromised, it is recommended that you want to spread them out also. And that's really their thinking, so that they can have vaccine mediated protection over a longer time over the season. So if all three vaccines were given at the same time, then they kind of wane at the same time. So they could prefer that they be staggered for that population. So in general, if a resident is requesting all three vaccines at the same time and their provider agrees, they can be given. It can increase side effects. And if someone is concerned about side effects or they're immunocompromised, then you'll want to spread them out.
Thank you, Shirley.
You're welcome.
So now we're going to move into some questions about antipsychotics. One says, we are concerned about the number of antipsychotics in our facility and would like to stay in compliance with the gradual dose reduction regulations. Can you please tell me how often we have to do a GDR?
So I can talk about antipsychotics for a little bit. GDRs are always challenging for facilities. I know when I was medical director, I always found them difficult. And we know that a GDR is required unless it's clinically contraindicated within the first year that a resident is admitted to the facility on a psychotropic, not necessarily an antipsychotic. It could be a benzodiazepine. It could be an antidepressant. But it has to be done, but within the first year that the resident is admitted to the facility or after that antipsychotic is initiated. And the facility must make a GDR attempt in two separate quarters with at least 1 month between attempts in the first year. A GDR attempt must be made at least annually after the first year. So you have to keep this in mind. Once you do your first two attempts, you have to do it annually every year after that. Appendix PP has a little bit more verbiage around GDRs. And, you know, the idea is that you don't really have to wait for a GDR in order to initiate a reduction, and that reductions really need to be patient-based. So I would really keep this in mind and make sure you're getting a lot of input, not just from your physician or your neuropsychologist or psychiatrist, but from your entire interdisciplinary team that can really give you some input about behaviors and is an antipsychotic needed? Can a gradual dose reduction be done? All of this kind of thing. A GDR is clinically contraindicated, and this does happen. You can document that a GDR is contraindicated if the current use is in accordance with relevant current standards of practice. So you have to actually be using the drug to treat something that is in the current standards of practice, and the physician has documented the clinical rationale for use of the antipsychotic, or the resident's target symptoms have returned or worsened after you did a GDR previously. But that GDR failure has to actually have been done within the facility, and the physician has to document that the GDR failed and the clinical rationale for continuing the antipsychotic.
Thank you, Jean. The next question says, if we are creating our own gradual dose reduction template, what items should be included in this template?
So I'm sure most of you have a pharmacist who every month will give you recommendations for when a gradual dose reduction should occur for an antipsychotic, and they're typically keeping track of the schedule of the gradual dose reduction. But these pharmacy documents are typically not very involved. What I would do is I would create your own template that would include the date of the discussion that you're just talking about the gradual dose reduction, the name of the resident, the physician, the medication in question, the dose, the frequency, the length of therapy that the resident has been on the medication, the diagnosis for the medication, what behaviors you're targeting. Are you talking about harm to self or others versus exit seeking? So these behaviors are very, very different. And we have to make sure that those behaviors are actually documented in the resident records. And then also, it's really important to include on your GDR template the risks and benefits of continuing the medication as discussed in the interdisciplinary team meeting. And I would include an area on the template which would describe whether a reduction is going to be done. And if yes, if the reduction is going to be done, it needs to be done very conservatively and obviously with a physician. And if no, a description about why a reduction is not being done and how the resident's well-being and quality of life are going to be impacted with a gradual dose reduction. I would also in this area include a discussion about how the benefits outweigh the risks for the resident. And I really think it's important in documentation for survey purposes that you really have an understanding of the risks and the benefits for each individual resident, because I think that this is definitely going to be protection in survey, because it's showing that you actually have a process to think through, because antipsychotics are harmful medications. They carry a black box warning in the elderly, which in older adults, which means that they increase mortality. They increase someone's chance that they will die early. So we really want to make sure that there's very good documentation that the benefits outweigh those risks of mortality. And it's important to involve psychiatry, psychology, neuropsychology. To get support in the GDR process, they can really weigh in on the process. And again, it's important to keep in mind that you can do a GDR more frequently than is required if the risks outweigh the benefits for a resident.
Thank you, Jean. So our next questions that we'll have are about the minimum data set. The first question is an OSA required in a Medicaid certified facility for all residents, regardless of payer source?
So Kathy, I can take these. Yes, if you are a facility that is Medicaid certified, you are required to submit an OSA with the same ARD as all federally required PPS and OBRA assessments. They still get submitted through the IKE system. So regardless of the payer source, if your facility is Medicaid certified, you do have to complete those OSA assessments.
Thank you. And the next question is, when opening the OSA, how is item A0300B to be answered?
Sure. So I've been getting a lot of questions about this because they're not sure how to code to, because it nowhere on the MDS in the questions does it say OSA. However, section A0300 is titled optional state assessment. So that's where you're answering these questions. So at A0300, optional state assessment, the first question is A, is the assessment for state payment purposes only? And for Pennsylvania and West Virginia, that answer would be yes. And then when you get to A0300B, the assessment type, that type would be number 5, other payment assessments. So both states that we work with, Pennsylvania and West Virginia, are currently doing the OSAs. So the answer would be yes. And then 0300B would be 5 other payment assessment.
So our last question about the MDS says, if the assessment is optional state assessment, why is this completed if it is optional?
That's another great question, and one that I'm getting a lot. And some people are starting to confuse the optional state assessment or the OSA with the IPA assessment, which the IPA is for your PPS assessments. And that one is truly optional. But the OSA is optional in the fact of effective October 1st, 2023, states that didn't transition or adopt the PDPM model for their Medicaid payment will be required to complete a concurrent OSA in order to have their MA reimbursement established. So that's where the optional piece comes in. It's state specific. Did your state adopt the PDPM module? And if not, then they had to do the optional state assessment in order to get that made Medicaid reimbursement established for the residents. So that's where the optional comes in. And for Pennsylvania and West Virginia, they are currently doing the OSAs in order to establish their Medicaid reimbursement.
Okay, thank you. This question says, during a staff satisfaction survey, it came to light that our staff does not feel their voices are heard. We felt like we were doing a good job with that. Do you have any suggestions?
Kathy, I'll be happy to take this one. And it is a great question. Thank you so much for asking. Satisfaction surveys are really becoming much more a part of our lives as we continue to struggle with staffing challenges, right? So for sure, they're great tools to help us kind of get the lay of the land a little bit with what's going on out there with our staff. And really, it's pretty common for our staff to sometimes feel as if they are not valued or not being heard. So creating that sense of empowerment and team can be a little bit of a process and might take a little bit of time. It really comes down to building a culture in your building that supports that. You know, there was a time that when we said we had an open door policy, that's kind of the phrase that we use to let everyone know that you can come to us with everything and anything. And we said those words with the absolute best of intentions. But having an open door policy and people speaking freely, while it's important, isn't really going to validate your employees or empower them to complete their job duties in a way that they're really capable of doing. So one thing that can help to build that culture of empowerment is creating a really clear communication pathway in which everybody knows where they need to take their thoughts, their concerns, even their kudos. Where do they take them and who do they take them to? When do they take them? Maybe even more important is what the receiver of the message does with that message once it's given. So communication, we know, is a two-way street, and the receiver of the message should first validate the importance of what that message is. If somebody takes the time to bring something forward, it's important to them, and therefore it kind of needs to be important to you as well. Next, we need to make sure that the message that they're trying to give us is indeed the message that we hear. And that can be very easily done in 10 seconds by simply rephrasing what you heard the message as, and then giving them, the person sending the message, the opportunity to correct anything that you might not have understood correctly. Next, let the person know what you're going to do with that message. And that doesn't mean that you're going to take action on what the message is conveying, or that the action is going to be what the message sender is hoping for. What it does mean is that at the close of the interaction, the sender knows what to expect. They knows what they know what is going to happen with the information they're giving you. And finally, and probably most importantly, follow up. Go past taking action and reacting to the information that you've been given, and follow up with the person who began the communication to close that loop. That process of creating a clear pathway, validating the message, restating the message, setting a plan, and then following up will begin to form a culture of trust and true open communication that can really help to empower your team and kind of take that to the very next level. And then before we get off of this topic, there are situations when you're creating that clear pathway that open door policies kind of don't count. There are situations that need to be brought forward immediately in a very consistent manner. So when it comes to resident care, again, set that expectation of what needs to be reported, when it needs to be reported, and who it needs to be reported to. Things like Mr. and Mrs. Jones having a little argument at lunch can wait until the shift change report, right? But if Mrs. Smith falls in the bathroom, that's going to require an immediate report. And that seems simple, but everybody needs to understand what it is that requires an immediate notification. Things like abnormal lab work. When does that abnormal lab move from the stack of papers that's sitting waiting for the physician's assistant to come in to an immediate call to a physician? Clear communication on what that expectation looks like can help you avoid some pretty negative results. So when your staff feels like they're conveying an important message and that message is not being heard, especially in this clinical arena, there's a system called CUS that we've talked about before that is a very simple technique that can help you kind of escalate an issue. The C in CUS stands for concern, the U stands for uncomfortable, and the S stands for safety. And it's really important that you use those three words, concern, uncomfortable, and safety, when you're utilizing this format to escalate something. So it's important for everybody to understand that if they hear those words in conjunction with each other, that you're concerned about something, you're uncomfortable with the way the trajectory is going, and that you believe it's a safety issue and why, that's kind of like the hard stop. We got to pay attention to this in a little bit different kind of way. So I hope that answered your question. I know I kind of veered off on a different topic there, but I hope that helped.
Thank you, Patty. And it looks like we're not getting any extra questions, so I'm going to wrap us up real quick. I'd like to thank all of our panelists for joining us here today, and I'd like to thank all of you for joining us, and we hope to see you again here next week.
You can check out our other interviews at qualityinsights.org/QIN/multimedia.